So this might not surprise
Java
you,
SE
but
fundamentals.
There's some things I think about a lot.
Java SE fundamentals.
Now,
Java
so
SE
you guys just run to this place, right? It's like, what does he think about?
In the course,
believe
Java
or not,
SE
what I think about
fundamentals
a lot is kind of
have Pluralsight.
What makes
Java
someone
SE fundamentals.
Kind of stop going to church?
Java SE fundamentals.
What makes someone
Pluralsight.
Start going to church? Why does someone pick the church that they do? I mean, what are the things that are behind that? You know, is it family tradition? It's kind of what I've always done. You know, is it a theology thing? Is it that just it so theologically connects with you perfectly that that's what you're holding on to? Is it just the location? I will tell you, when I returned to church years ago, there was one 2 blocks away that I could walk to, and I was like, well, really no excuse here. Might as well go. Right? There's all kinds of things that can drive it. But the thing that's kind of interesting to me is you could take two churches that are very similar, theologically very close to one another, very similar to one another. There are similar distances from population centers. There could be other aspects that are similar. Yet one church could be growing and overflowing, and another church isn't. So what's going on there? What is the thing, or what are some of the key things that really lead to a difference in that outcome? So recently, Bonnie and I were talking to a friend of ours who we've known for many years, and we actually met in church. Is that we actually had both moved to a new area right around the same time. We're going to the same church, got to know each other, and we've actually kind of stayed connected, even though we're up here now and she's down in Florida. And the thing that was interesting to me is that as we've been talking to her in recent years, she's been feeling kind of disconnected from church. And she has moved from church to church trying to find a place to feel connected. She even stopped going to church for a while. And the thing that's important for me to say to you is that she is someone who is a very faith-filled person. Her Christianity is very important to her. The Christian lifestyle is very important to her. Yet she was having a really hard time feeling connected. You know, so much so that a person who had faithfully gone to church for years stopped. But in these recent years, as we've been talking to her, as time has gone forward, she's began to reconnect. And the thing is that the church that she's feeling connected in is not a denomination that she aligns with. I mean, it's a Christian church, but even theologically, there are a lot of things that she doesn't really agree with. Yet, this has become a connected church family for her somehow. So I guess the question is, what did she find there that she wasn't finding elsewhere? Well, it's going to take you 20 minutes to find out. Right? Because that's what I want to talk about today. What is it? What went on in her life, and what do we know is happening? What is causing these things to happen? So remember that this week we're continuing our series, What If Self-Help Isn't the Best Help? And our goal as we go through this is that, you know, how do we get to have a life that's filled with meaning, with peace, with purpose, to have a life where we feel healthy and whole? You know, and we've talked a lot throughout this series about the importance of having something in your life that you really feel driven to be a part of and to make a difference in. And that a key part of having meaning, peace, and purpose in your own life is helping other people to have that. Now, I've been talking about that generally throughout most of the series, but today I want to talk about something really specific. The church. Where does the church fit in that? What is the role of the church and all that? Now, remember that throughout this series, we've been using language that kind of models being on a journey. That our destination is this life that feels whole and filled and meaningful. And we're trying to get from where we are now to that place. So anytime when you're on a journey, imagine you didn't have Google Maps, you didn't have your GPS system. You know, those of us who are old enough to remember asking for directions, sort of thing. When you were driving around and you weren't quite sure what the place looked like or when you were there, what's the question you would ask? Well, is this the place? So my question to us is this the place where people find those things? Is this the place where people find those things they're looking for that help them feel more connected, more whole, have a life that feels more meaningful. What is the role of a church in that? And what is the role of our church in that? Now, as we go through this series, we're following the life of some guy named Nehemiah. I've kind of described it in detail for the last 3 weeks, so just a really quick reminder. He lived 2,500 years ago, so he's in the ancient world. He was part of the exiled nation of Israel, which means they had been conquered over a century earlier. He had been a servant to the king. And he learned that although people had been driven from the city for a time, they had been allowed to return. So the families that had been driven out, their descendants had been allowed to return, which should have been good news, but it wasn't. Because he learned that the perimeter of the city had been so badly destroyed that after over a century of destruction and all the things that go with that, the perimeter was not a source of protection anymore. And so he wanted to make a difference there. So given that it seemed almost impossible that he would be able to help, he stepped out, he tried, and as we followed him, he actually got to the city, he got to start on the project, and he started bringing people together to work on it, as unlikely as that sounds. Now, the thing that's really interesting, just to set a time frame for us, by the time that Nehemiah gets there to do the work, 140 years have passed since the nation was conquered, since the initial destruction of the city. And over that 140 years, the people living there, are obviously across generations, the people living there had had some really hopeful things happen, that the kings would allow some of the people to return. Some of the kings, or one of the kings, even allowed them to rebuild the temple. And that's really important, right? Because remember that in ancient Judaism, the temple is the source and the center, not the source, but the center of faith. That their entire faith revolved around the temple. So when that initial temple was destroyed, to them, it's kind of like, where did God even go? That's the sort of thing and sort of pain that they were experiencing. So one of the kings allows them to rebuild their temple. Now that was really exciting. But it took 20 years to rebuild the temple, meaning that some people would have seen the project start and not lived to see it finished. But now time has gone on, more people have returned. And now Nehemiah has shown up to actually do the work that he feels called to do, to reconstruct this perimeter, to reestablish the wall around the city, to get the gates back in place. He's drawn to do all those things. But now think about it. It took 20 years to rebuild a temple. He's trying to reconstruct something that goes entirely around the city. How long is that going to take? Well, Nehemiah tells us this. So on October 2nd, the wall was finished, just 52 days after we had begun. So as we join Nehemiah this week, he just finished a project in a month and a half that had been waiting 140 years to be finished. Now, how could he possibly do that? I mean, again, the temple took 20 years. He's surrounding an entire city here. How did he possibly do that? Well, he did a few things that are really important. I mean, one thing we know is that he planned ahead. He'd actually put together a plan of what he wanted to do. We kind of saw that in the first week. We know he prepared, he pulled together the things that he needed. We saw that in the second week so that he could actually get to work. And last week we saw that he did something really important. He stayed focused, which for some of us is the hardest thing of all to do. But of course he didn't have smartphones and the internet, so that probably made it easier to stay focused. But he did stay focused, and he did have distractions, and he did have people kind of actually working against him, and he had the people that were with him getting tired and frustrated and scared. But remember what he said as things started to try to distract him from the work? He says, I'm doing a great work, and I am unable to come down. Why should the work stop? Well, I come down to you. And in the abstract, that sounds a little bit arrogant, but no, that was just focus. That he knew what was the most important thing. You know, that there's this kind of classic management saying that we hold on to. Do not let the urgent interfere with the important. Right? Do not let the urgent interfere with the important. That when we're doing something that is important, there are going to be lots of urgent things that pop up. But how often do we, or in the middle of concentrating and trying to do something, we hear an email come in or the phone rings and we stop and we do that? How long does it take you to get back into what you were doing once you stop? And particularly if you're like reading an email, it's like, oh, wow, I wonder what's going on in the world today. Let me go to the internet now. Let me click around for a bit, you know? Or I'm a big YouTube guy. It's like, oh, I'll just watch one video sort of thing, which becomes two videos and three videos and that sort of thing. But he didn't do that. He stayed focused on what's important, not letting the urgent interrupt the important. Now, all those things are really important, but just those things alone couldn't have done it. Right? No matter how well he planned, no matter how well he prepared, no matter how focused he was, he alone could not have this kind of success. So what else did he do? Well, remember, why was Nehemiah doing this project? Was it because he wanted to be the guy who was known for rebuilding around the city, that he was the one who came in and put that great, beautiful wall up with his name on the side? Is that what Nehemiah was there to do? He wasn't. He was there to help people. Remember that for him, fixing the perimeter of that city was about giving people a better life, a safer life, a more whole life. And since his motivation was not the perimeter itself, but the people that it helped, he invested in people. He realized that in order to do this, to do this well, he had to invest in the people. And I would say that the investment in people is the key part of success in anything important that we do. And it was essential in his case. Because one of the things that Nehemiah understood is that every person needs to have a sense of value. Every person needs a sense of value. The way to destroy someone's hope in life is just destroy their sense of value. And many of the people living in the city had that feeling for a very long time. And Nehemiah understood that there were two sides to a human being's sense of value. One part of it is every person needs to feel valuable. Every person needs to feel that they're an important part of something important. Every person needs to feel that they are an important part of something important. So he brought the people in together, and the people worked together on the project, that they understood that they were an important part of something important, that each person mattered in the project, and they each had a place in it. So he brought them in, and they worked on the project, each one of them doing what they could do. But in addition to having a sense of being valuable, he also understood that people needed something else. They needed to feel valued. Right? Valuable means that what you do has significance. The actions you take, your abilities, your participation has significance. Valued is separate from that. Every person needs to feel valued no matter what they can do. Right? Every human being is a child of God, a loved child of God. And so when a person feels valued, they're loved for who they are, not what they can do. And it's that idea of separating a person from their behavior. Right? Valuable means there's a behavior or a skill you have. Yeah, that's really important. We need those skills. But some of us are at a place in our life where we can't do those things. Does that make them less valued? Or do they mean less to God? Do I mean less to God? And the answer is no. But here's the reality is that we can walk around and tell people all day that God loves you, God, you know, you're valued by God. That'll only get you so far. People need to feel it. They need to see it. They need to see it from other people. That we are responsible to bring that into other people's lives. So what Nehemiah did is he focused on those things of helping people to feel valuable and helping people to know that they are valued. And then he brought them all together, these valued, valuable people, he brought them all together into a community where everybody participated as best they could. And he pulled together people of all different levels of capability. Some people were leaders, so they led. Other people were highly skilled craftsmen, so they used whatever their craft was. You know what other people did? They carried stuff. They made food. They did what they could. Some people were soldiers, so they protected people. Everybody did what they could do together as a community. And no matter where they were on the skill or leadership level, they were all valued as one community. And the power of that community was so important for Nehemiah and the work they were doing. Because one of the things that Nehemiah was really good at was encouraging people to stretch themselves, to do a little bit more than comes easily, to do a little bit more than they already know how to do. Now, in order for that to be okay, those people had to feel supported. It had to be okay to go a little too far, and maybe I can't do it by myself. So someone will step in and they'll help me. Or if I fall, someone will catch me. And people would understand that I was going beyond what I can normally do, and we would be together, and that didn't make me less valued. And so he built that they were a community of people who felt valued, not just by God, but by other human beings, and were valuable in the project. And here's the thing is that if we kind of bring this into the present, but the reality is it's true for all of humankind. If we do not feel part of a community, if we do not feel valuable, if we do not feel valued, that leads to a darkness, leads to overconsumption of any number of things. It can lead to isolation. It leads to hopelessness if we don't have those things. And we know, right? All you have to do is read a newspaper. We live in a time where that is an overwhelming reality of the day, where people feel just disconnected. People who really don't even have a sense of what an in-person community even is. That's the time that we live in. And now we could just sit back and say, I don't know what's wrong with these kids. What's their problem? A couple things about that. First of all, they're not all kids. People of all ages who have that issue. I even know people who were very social earlier in their lives and have gotten older and become more isolated. So we need to be part of something that fixes that. It can be, at least, I shouldn't say fixes it. We need to be part of something that helps us find our way to the other side of that, recognizing that getting to the other side of that is not just a fix, it's a journey. It takes, again, a community, support, people who value you, those sort of things. But what's interesting is that I would be pretty sure that within, I'd say, a mile of this place, there's somebody who's depressed right now. There's somebody sitting home alone who ate cereal for dinner last night and is eating cereal for breakfast this morning, alone, and probably doesn't feel great about it. I bet there's more than one. So around us, these things are going on. And we would say that, well, we're the church, right? The church, you can find those things here, right? You'll find community here. You'll find a sense of value here. But they're not coming here. Many of them are going anywhere. I'm not isolating. I'm not singling us out. The point is that they're not going anywhere. Why is that? Because they don't think they're going to find it here. We're up the road a block. We're on the other side of town. They don't think that's what a church does. People are longing for these things. But when they look for a solution, they don't believe they're going to find it in the church. Their expectation is it's not here. So again, what can we do? We can sit back and blame them. That's not very helpful. And it's probably not even accurate. It's not really their fault. It's just kind of what has happened. Or we can say we're not going to accept that, that we're going to overcome it. They're going to do the work that it takes to connect with those people somehow, to reach out to those people somehow to get them to see that there's something that they didn't know existed. So how do we do that? Well, fortunately, we're walking through Nehemiah. And Nehemiah actually gives us, again, a framework for what we should do. Now, we focus very much on Nehemiah's kind of going out and doing the work to rebuild the perimeter. But in order to do that work, Nehemiah had to have the authority to do the work. So when he went out to do the work, the king made him the governor of the city, which gave him authority to do things, which is good. That helped him to do the work he had to do. But the position of governor comes with privilege. It comes with the right to tax people. And in that time frame, taxing people meant demanding money like silver, as well as demanding food and wine. And prior to Nehemiah, the governors had fully exercised that privilege, that they taxed the people heavily. And they even allowed the people who were close to them, the governors allowed the people close to them, to put burdens on people. Now, what's interesting is that none of this was Nehemiah's fault. Nehemiah didn't have that intent, but yet, that's what people expected from the governor, that the governor would come in and fully exercise his privilege to do the things that he wanted to do, because he had that authority. So Nehemiah had to decide that he wasn't going to do that. So what did he do? He basically had to do more than just say, hey, I'm not going to do that. He had to demonstrate it. So what Nehemiah tells us is that he sets out to lighten people's burdens. What he says is, the former governors, in contrast, had laid heavy burdens on the people, demanding a daily ration of food and wine, besides 40 pieces of silver. Even their assistants took advantage of the people. But because I feared God, I did not act that way. So what did Nehemiah do? He showed people that they are the priority, that they are the thing that's important. Basically, he put people ahead of his power, his privilege, even his protocol, the way things are done, so that he could connect with people, so he could reach them, to make a difference in their lives. Here's the key thing he did, is that very often we can get very focused on what we have the right to do. I have the right to do this. Nehemiah had the right to tax people. But he also had a responsibility. He had a responsibility to care for people, to lift people up. And he chose to put his responsibility to reach and care for people, his responsibility to serve people, he put that ahead of his right to tax the people, of his right to sit back and have other people work. Now again, there's no question that many of those people had had bad experiences with governors, and so they had every right not to trust a governor. And again, that wasn't Nehemiah's fault. But he could have just sat back and said, it's not my fault. I'm going to do what the governor gets to do, and whatever the outcome is the outcome. That was one option that he had. Or he could say, people are my priority. And I'm going to give up the things I'm entitled to. I'm going to do things differently than I'm allowed to do them so that I can reach them. And it turns out what we learn from Nehemiah is not only did he not tax the people and not receive the food and wine he was allowed to do, or allowed to receive, he also used his own resources to lighten people's burdens so he could continue to serve the people, to do the work that he felt called to do. And see, the choice that he faced, this choice of, as is he as governor, going to be able to do whatever he wants to do, whatever he's allowed to do, because whatever problems those people had wasn't his fault, is kind of the same choice that we face. That it's not your fault that people don't expect things from a church. Right? Some people have a very negative view of church. They may have had negative experiences in church. They may have known someone who had negative experiences in church. There's also just a real possibility, in fact, I'd say a likelihood, most people just aren't even thinking about us. They're not thinking about church. Doesn't make them bad people. Just they had a different life experience than we did. And that life experience led them down a path that they don't think about church. That's not your fault. It's not my fault. It's not this church's fault. But a major challenge of the church in North America is it's not our fault, but what are churches doing about it? How are we going to make a difference? What can we do? So we need to decide, just like Nehemiah needed to decide, are we going to just say that, well, we'll just do what we do what we've always done, and it'll be what it's going to be? Or do we say that, I want to do something different? I want to go out and do what it takes to reach people. I want to do what it takes in here to reach people. I want to do what it takes where we can attract people who don't just come from other churches, but people who have never been to a church. And here's kind of the thing. For Nehemiah, he actually had a choice. But if you're a Jesus follower, if you consider yourself a Christian, a Jesus follower, whatever term you like, we don't really get a choice. Because Jesus makes that pretty clear. So I think the answer for us is that we need to think about the sort of things that Nehemiah was doing, this idea of building a community that focuses on people feeling valuable and valued, and even if they've never been part of such a thing. And this idea of this of needing to adapt and change and do things differently, even if they're not the sort of things that we necessarily like, this is not a new challenge. In fact, the Apostle Paul actually directly addresses this. So reading a letter he wrote somewhere around the year 50 or 65, somewhere in that window of time. So 20 to 30 years after Jesus. He was writing a letter to a church. The church was located in the city of Corinth. Right? You know it as 1 Corinthians. And one of the things he's talking to the church about, well, he's talking to them about many things, about how to be a church and what you should do. But one of the areas that he directly addresses is that, how do you interact with people who are non-Christians or are kind of what we call a nominal Christian? They're aware of Christianity, but they're just not doing a lot with it, or just not very mature in it. So he talks about, what do you do if you want to connect with non-Christians and nominal Christians? What should you do? So Paul says this, "For though I am free from all, I had made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them." So what he's saying here is that if you're someone who is a mature Christian, if I'm someone who's a mature Christian, for fairness, the word mature is rarely applied to me, right? But if you are a mature Christian, what Paul says is that we need to think less about what we deserve and what we're allowed to have. We think need to think more about being a servant. A servant to non-Christians, a servant to nominal Christians, a servant to our peers here. Now, where in the world would Paul get the idea that being a Christian means you're supposed to be a servant? Well, Jesus, the one who had infinite entitlement, became a servant to all, to people of his time, people of our time. So Paul's saying that's what Jesus did, so that's what he's going to do. And he says to that church that he's writing to 2,000 years ago and to us today that we need to think about our responsibility to reach people above our right to have exactly what we want. That sounds so scary when I say it out loud. It's not horrible. Don't worry. It sounds scary when I say it. But the idea is that we are called to be a servant, and we do need to be willing to let go of our favorite things. That if we want to see these pews begin to fill, if we want children being here to be more than an anomaly at times, we need to do things differently. I don't mean burn the place down, but I do mean that we have to adjust things. That what a child needs to be more important than what we want. What a young family needs to be more important than what we want. Because that is our responsibility. That is what we are called to do. And Paul really reinforces this again because he continues in that same letter. And he says, Just as I try to please everyone in everything I do, not seeking my own advantage, but the advantage of many, that they may be saved. Paul is saying that we need to be willing to adapt. That was one of the challenges that young church had 2,000 years ago, that they weren't willing to adapt, which sounds kind of funny to us, right? Because it's like, what did they have to adapt to? Well, they were in a place surrounded by non-Christians and many nominal Christians, many more non-Christians. And why did the church, why did the first 300 years, in 300 years, the Christian church went from 12 people to a few hundred to being the one of the largest religions in the world? Because they adapted to their environment. They adapted to the needs of the people around them, that the people who were mature in the faith were willing to reach out and create an environment that connected with people who were not that. So what does it mean for us? What are we called to do? How are we meant to connect with this world around us? What are the just kind of big picture things? What do we need to do? Well, we need to do the same sort of thing, the same sort of thing that Nehemiah did when he was connecting to the people that he was serving, which is the same sort of thing that the Apostle Paul describes, that we as the church, first of all, need to be a place where people find community, right? That we need to be a place, of course, where people come together. But when they come together, they feel connected, quickly feel connected. You know, there's this old joke, right? I moved to New Hampshire in the year 2000, so I've been here for 24 years, actually this month, 24 years. I'm still considered a newbie, right? Because in New Hampshire, if you weren't born here, well, good luck. Maybe your grandkids will kind of be native, sort of thing, right? Right, but, and obviously none of us think that way here about church, but it's more than not thinking that way. I mean, it's important that we don't think that way. That would be really hard to overcome, but I think we're all welcoming to people emotionally. I mean, we want folks here. But just like God loving you should be enough to know you're loved, it's not. We need people to show us that we're loved, that we need to kind of really go out of our way to create that sense of community. In addition to that, people need to feel valuable, right? People need to feel that they're an important part of something important, that people need to feel that they're part of something bigger than themselves, right? That is a critical part of human existence, that one of the biggest emptinesses we can have in life is to feel like we're just working for ourselves or for our own little pod. But when we're part of something bigger than ourselves, it becomes life-changing connection somehow. So this needs to be a place where people come to and get to be a part of something bigger than themselves. And then finally, people need to feel valued. Right? Being valuable, again, is about the things that you can do. And we want to be valuable to use the abilities we have, whether we're highly skilled or lesser skilled. You know, like I couldn't feel less skilled when we were dealing with that heater. Like literally, you could have sent my cats in and they would have done as well with that heater as I did, sort of thing, right? But I still feel valuable sometimes, you know, right? The point is that we all have different skills. So that's where valuable comes in. But valued is different than that. Value is you're important because you're you. You were important to God, so you're important to me. And God put me on this earth to demonstrate to you how important you are to him. That we so often think that the way we prove our love for God is being super religious. No. The way we prove our love for God, or I shouldn't say prove, the way we demonstrate our love for God is by loving other people. I don't love this analogy, but it's kind of cool. That, you know, if you want to connect to God, you connect to other people. You want to share your love for God, you share your love for other people. The symbol of the cross is about more than crucifixion. It's about the fact as the family of God, we connect to those around us, and that connects us to the one above us. And so the way that we grow, the way that we transform things, the way that we become transformed is by prioritizing those sort of things. So back to Bonnie's and my friend. Why did she suddenly go to this church? That, again, that she does not align with theologically. She certainly doesn't align with denominationally. Again, it was a Christian church, so it's not like she went into another direction. But fundamentally, the theology is not what she has believed most her life. Well, because she was feeling disconnected, as I talked about, and they had an opportunity for her to actually volunteer. It was part of a big project. And so as she got involved as a volunteer, she started to feel valuable. Started to feel valuable. She was doing something that was bigger than herself. And here's the thing. When she first encountered the people who ran that program that she became a part of, she told them, I don't align with this church. I don't really connect with this theology. And they said, you know what they said? Not in so many words. But you don't have to believe to belong. You can belong here by just being with us. And she began to serve. And she felt more valuable. And the people came around her. And she became part of that community. And as she became part of the community, she got to know the people got to know her, and she started to see the love of God in her life. And she started to feel valued. Right? We all need these three things, right? Community, being valuable, being valued. They don't always come in the same order. But wholeness in life is by having those three things in your life. Those are the things that help people to connect to God. Because our friend, by starting with simply doing little more than carrying boxes, now she is now going to church there every Sunday. She's volunteering there 1 to 2 times a week. She's in a community group now. She is connected all the way through because she found a place to be part of something bigger than herself. And so as we kind of look forward, as we plan ahead, as we start to enter this kind of next stage of what we're doing, we need to be thinking about those three things. And we need to be thinking about this example that Nehemiah gives us, that Paul describes. That, you know, you guys have been here for years. Some of you have been here for decades. You know what? You have every right to just do what you want. You've earned it. But Jesus tells us we have a responsibility to let go of those rights and change the things we do so that we can do the work we're called to do. My prayer for each of us is that we can do that enthusiastically and energetically. I don't want to be peeling people's fingers off the back of the pews as we do things. Right? I want us to go along happily together, because I'll tell you, the reward is worth it. So my prayer is that we go forward with that attitude as we go forward from here.